37 women, one sister-in-law, 5 sets of sisters, 17 angels, approximately, 1 set of mothers and daughters, maybe 2, way too many teenagers, 1 set of stairs, 0 children, 2 episodes, priceless.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Cast your minds back, friends. Back to the beginning of time. Or at least until the polygamy overview episode. You will remember that you were instructed to put pins in many things. Put a pin in this, put a pin in that. We need a podcast voodoo doll. We will return to some of those pins here and now. For today's agenda is a very audacious plan. We aim to discuss Joseph Smith's polygamy in Nauvoo in a single episode. It's okay to laugh. It's really, really a fool's errand from the beginning. It's like when you're trying to shove everything into like one suitcase, or me as a college freshman at Utah State trying to carry all the week's groceries on the shuttle up to the apartment, all the way up the stairs. Or the Lion House in Salt Lake City. Part of your brain is saying, hey, dummy, there are things called the laws of physics. You can't physically fit everything in there. But it's like a test of your integrity. And you keep trying until you admit to yourself that you were an idiot to even attempt this, which is how I felt every time I brought my groceries in. But I did it. 10 bags, 5 on each arm. Yeah, this is going to be a two-parter. We'll talk about each of the women who married Joseph Smith as plural wives. Relax, it will be concise. It's not a year of polygamy. If you want more detail, remember that the first several dozen episodes of Year of Polygamy discuss each of these women and these stories in detail. Yeah, Brian, it's just really hard to talk about Nauvoo polygamy in one episode. What were you thinking?
We got to talk about them, but we can't take forever. It was a very difficult task because there is so much. Multiple books, long books, biographies of some of the specific women, but you need like all of them, their names, snapshots of them. So
here can you imagine being just a non-Mormon historian biographer to write about a dude and his one wife? That'd be pretty simple. But when you're a Mormon biographer or historian, you're like, let's talk about some of these Mormon patriarchs. It will go on into the eternities.
This is our first shout out to Todd Compton. In Sacred Loneliness, which is short biographies of each of Joseph Smith's wives, is such a daunting book to even think about. You read it and you get done, you're like, wow, that was a great book. But then think about writing it.
Well, Nauvoo, all of my Nauvoo research has been like this. Same for you, Brian. We keep getting lost on tangents. So we're going to have a lot of fun tangents this season. I'm really excited about it. So now we started this project before with the story of Louisa Beeman. Such a romantic story that every little girl dreams about. Louisa, scrap those plans for your white Victorian wedding. You get to get dressed up like a dude under a tree, and then your brother-in-law will repeat the words of a ceremony that your husband, Joseph Smith, is telling him. However, before we take one more step, let's have a timeout in the field for a second.
It's everybody's favorite tangent time. Real quick, like, let's just discuss sources. How do we know about these women and the relationship with Joseph Smith? 3 categories coming up. First, contemporary records. And if you know anything about Nauvoo-era polygamy, you're already nodding your head as I tell you, this category is kind of small. few journals, a couple letters, some land transactions, a couple revelations, and that's about the size of it. Second, affidavits. That's a word you don't get to hear enough. As a teaser for the wild 1860s, you just need to know for now that toward the end of that decade, the contest for who's going to be the successor to the legacy of Joseph Smith starts to heat up. The RLDS Church is formally organized in 1860 under the leadership of his son, Joseph Smith III. And thanks in large part to the influence of his mother, Emma, the RLDS trajectory very strongly rejects polygamy, often to the point of denying Joseph Smith's involvement, period, or at least his support of it. And as part of this battle, Joseph F. Smith, who, as the son of Joseph Smith's brother Hiram Smith, was then Joseph Smith III's cousin, he goes around in Utah later and he collects dozens of affidavits from people who were involved in polygamy, most notably the women who were plural wives. From these statements, we get some details about how they were introduced to the principle, when they were married, and even some details about life as an actual plural wife in Nauvoo. These affidavits that he collected were reintroduced to historians thanks to grad student Dan Backman in the 1970s and are so valuable to our understanding. Category 3, the Temple Lot case. So a legal case had developed toward the end of the 19th century regarding ownership of the Temple Lot property in Independence. The Church of Christ Temple Lot had actual possession of the key chunk of ground there, but the RLDS Church argues that they were the legitimate successors to the original church and therefore they should get it. The RLDS Church, behind the scenes, had quietly been supporting the Temple Lot Church, often called the Hedrickites, for a few years before this, and so then they jump in from the sidelines in this very thinly disguised middle finger to their RLDS cousins. So what happens is lawyers come out and they will take depositions, and then some of the wives even go back to testify. Several of Joseph Smith's plural wives testified about their polygamous relationships. The point here was to show that these non-polygamous RLDSers couldn't possibly be the legitimate successors to Joseph Smith's church. And it's actually a really solid point. It was a good strategy. Once again, thanks to a fight with the Midwest cousins, we, now, get these fantastic tidbits about the Nauvoo years. Okay, the affidavits were 25 years after the fact. Temple Lot testimony is 70 years old. So, we definitely have to put on our source credit hats and we use these materials with care. However, Joseph Smith polygamy deniers, and holy crap are they persistent, they'd love to point to this as one more evidence of this big Brighamite conspiracy to defame Joseph Smith. The large problem, aside from crappy reasoning, selective judgment, overall suckiness, I didn't say that, is that first category, contemporary records. Okay, tangents over, back to tonight's presentation.
Before Parowan was originally named Fort Louisa in her honor, 26-year-old Louisa Beeman became famous as the first solidly documented plural wife in Nauvoo. But why her? Her family were longtime members. I mean, as long as people can be in a church that's barely, what, 10 years old? Her father had been a rodsman. You may remember we talked about him briefly in the Magic Worldview episode, but interestingly, he died before Nauvoo, and then Louisa's mother passed away in 1840. And you'll notice a decent number of the women we talk about today were fatherless, if not completely parentless, by the Nauvoo era. And this becomes a theme of polygamy. And I will say that one of the reasons why I don't think that polygamy for the widows and the like orphans is a good argument for polygamy because it just sounds kind of predatory sometimes. What was the impetus for Louisa marrying Joseph Smith? This is one of those maddening gaps in our knowledge among many with polygamy because Joseph Smith used her brother-in-law Bates Noble as the go-between. It's possible that he had Bates introduce the idea to her, but we just don't know. Two elements to the story come from later accounts. Bates himself said Joseph Smith told him that an angel had commanded him to move forward with polygamy. Brigham Young added that Louisa had prayed for a testimony of the principle which she received. So both of these are common threads in many stories about polygamous marriages. However, once you base the proposal on threats of damnation to both parties, the usefulness of the testimony becomes less valuable. Strong persuasion, venturing into coercion territory, like we talked in the last episode, is a problematic component of any discussion of polygamy. And unfortunately, women didn't have those discussions about consent that we can have now, where if it's coercive, it doesn't mean that they necessarily wanted it. And in fact, if it is coercive, it probably suggests that it wasn't free and fully given, because free and fully given things don't really need to be coerced. But because this is such a controversial and what they would have seen as a hard sacrifice, it required such subterfuge, I guess. And we only get a few hints about her experience. She continues to live with her family. There are vague references to some financial support from Joseph Smith and stories about social gatherings with other plural wives in Nauvoo. But sadly, we have a complete lack of her voice in the story. She died in 1850, so she didn't live very long, and we don't have affidavits or testimonies from her.
6 months later, Zina Huntington married Joseph Smith. Sorry, Zina Huntington Jacobs. Who was Jacobs, you ask? Well, you know, Henry Jacobs, her husband. Yep, saddle up, friends. With this marriage, we begin a very strange period filled with mostly polyandrous marriages. So these women are already civilly married to another husband by the time they marry Joseph Smith in a spiritual ceremony. So in an already spicy soup, this concept of marrying already married women is very noticeable, and it is one of those aspects that just will not go away and is really difficult to explain in a satisfactory way. So here we go. All right, you ready for a good story? According to Zina's granddaughter and biographer, Zina and Henry were scheduled to be married by Joseph Smith. However, they show up, no Joseph. And they're married instead by John C. Bennett. It's kind of surprising he didn't invoke prima nocta, frankly. So later, they ask Joseph Smith, where were you? Why didn't you show up? He tells her, quote, it had been made known to him that she was to be his celestial wife, and he could not give to another one who had been given to him. Okay, gotcha. And this speaks to the idea we mentioned last time that Joseph Smith told several of the wives, mostly the already married ones, that they were designated as his wives in a premortal state. Yeah, angels with flaming swords plus premortal dibs really puts a hurt on this concept of consent in these marriages. Later accounts, even from Zina herself, portrayed her marriage to Henry as unhappy, but it seems more likely that this was an attempt to help the polyandry medicine go down in a slightly more delightful way. The husbands in these cases seem to be believing Mormons who also love their wives. Surprise! Abrahamic test time guy. And this wasn't an easy decision for Zina. Thankfully, in this case, we get to hear directly from her. In an autobiographical sketch later in life, she declared, quote, I made a greater sacrifice than to give my life, for I never anticipated again to be looked upon as an honorable woman by those I dearly loved. How could I compromise conscience and lay aside the sure testimony of the Spirit of God for the glory of this world? And from this, we get kind of a window into the mental stress that living this secret existence caused for these women. Oh, and did we mention she was also 6 months pregnant with Henry's child when she marries Joseph Smith? And that because she was sealed to Joseph Smith, not Henry, this slowly developing theology designated that child as Joseph's? Yeah, there's that too.
After marrying Zina Huntington, Joseph Smith wed Presindia Huntington. Now, we know by now that you, gentle listeners, have already demonstrated your above average intelligence. You're listening to this podcast, right? You're geniuses. So, yes, you are correct. Presindia was, in fact, Zina's sister. Fun fact, her sister Presindia was also already married to a Mr. Norman Buell and had been for 15 gloriful years. Having a sister for a sister wife is the theme that continues on down to contemporary polygamists. And a lot of the polygamists I know say that it's actually the easiest situation to marry sisters because they're used to getting along and living in the same space. And they're used to sharing family members and attention from family members. So yeah, that sounds good. It's kind of your ideal thing for sister wives is to be two sisters together. And sometimes it works out exactly as planned. But I think you can also see how this could make the experience actually more difficult. Your mileage may vary on that, but some of you might not want to share your husband with your sister. Zina's brother, Dimmock Huntington, again played the role of liaison, marrying Presendia to Joseph Smith just as he had with Zina 6 weeks before. Again, it was claimed that her first husband, Norman, was not a good candidate to get her to the Celestial Kingdom, as he was on the outs with Mormonism. And this time it does seem to be true that Norman was disaffected, but that's disaffected from the church, not his wife. Still not a good explanation. But I will say that this is something that we still, that is also carried down into fundamentalists. Some fundamentalist circles believe that if a husband isn't worthy, then you can get rearranged to someone else or sealed to someone else. I've had fundamentalist men tell me that they could, that my husband's priesthood didn't count and I could get sealed to a higher priesthood.
And as you pointed out in a Sunstone presentation, that's not like Warren Jeffs inventing this. This goes back to Brigham Young. He will explicitly say in Utah just that, that if your husband isn't worthy enough, then you can go find one with better priesthood.
I mean, I know a woman who, I think I've alluded to this on the podcast. We've never told her story publicly, but she's a good friend of mine, and she was groomed to be a plural wife from her LDS bishop, who was later excommunicated. He groomed their family, and his justification was that their dad, who they love, who they're still close to, and is in a beautiful marriage with her mom, he was not active. And so the bishop saw it as his role to take her under the wing. This happens all the time.
So after that, by 1842, polygamy takes on yet another wrinkle. Just 6 days into the new year, Joseph Smith marries Agnes Coolbrith, who was married. Sort of. Her husband had actually died a few months earlier. Oh, and he was also Joseph Smith's little brother, Don Carlos. One late recollection indicates that Don Carlos, knowing he was dying, expresses a desire for Agnes to then marry Joseph Smith. On the flip side, another reminiscent account has Don Carlos declaring anyone who taught spiritual wifery would go to hell. You know, you have fun sifting through those. And here, I wish I could tell you what Agnes thought about all this, but alas, no dice. Agnes, she remains mostly amicable with her Mormon cousins, but was done. So once the Brigham dudes leave for Utah, she goes to California. She will remember Joseph Smith in warm terms, but that's really about all we can say with her. She corresponds with her nephew, Joseph F. Smith, throughout her life. And it's mostly friendly, but polygamy is kind of the elephant in the room that they don't really talk about. One interesting thing about her, though, if you remember when we talked about her marriage a couple episodes ago, we mentioned that Brigham Young witnessed and very likely performed the ceremony. When he talks about this in his journal, he uses a Masonic cipher to record a key word. The sentence says Joseph Smith saw or was, so S-A-W or W-A-S, Agnes. And we got us a fancy two-level code here. Historians who write about this think that this word stands for either sealed and wedded or vice versa. And codes and polygamy will go together like podcasting and large beverages.
Next up is the action figure hero of plural wives, Mary Elizabeth Rollins. Right now is the test of how good of a job we've done, because hopefully a bell is dinging in the back of your mind. We've talked about Miss Mary before. Back in the scripture episode, she and her sister Caroline were the two responsible for saving pages for the Book of Commandments, the first published collection of Joseph Smith's revelations, and they kind of make it into early Mormon history lore, like these guys are sort of folk heroes of this Missouri period. We also talk about her polygamy-specific experience briefly last time. And Mary is fascinating because she left several document accounts of her introduction to polygamy. And one of the accounts comes from a speech to BYU students, hashtag make firesides great again. However, what she has to say is tough to deal with. Listen to this. In 1834, Joseph was commanded to take me for a wife. I was 1,000 miles from him. He got afraid. The angel came to him 3 times. The last time was with a drawn sword and threatened his life. I did not believe. If God told him so, why did he not come and tell me? The angel told him I should have a witness. An angel came to me. It went through me like lightning. I was afraid. Joseph said I was his before I came here, and he said all the devils in hell should never get me from him. End quote. Now, this one's hard. This one's hard for me personally, because I remember when I've talked openly about my experience about when I was married. I was engaged to someone else, married someone else. And I remember in the temple on the day of our sealing, wondering if I had done the right thing. I was, you know, leaving this person who I was just in love with and not marrying them because the spirit told me not to. And it felt like a bolt of lightning hit me. And I took that as a sign don't ever think about him again. I'm in the temple. But now I read her thing and I'm like, ugh, that's how the angel came to her, a feeling like that. It's always kind of stuck with me. Also, as we described in the last episode, Mary Rollins went through a closed door interview in Joseph Smith's store, and I kind of hate these stories. We talked about this with Bennett. It's not a good situation. Again, if you put it in any other context with Mormons, other than Mormons, you'd be like, what the heck? That's really messed up. But Mormons are like, no, this is great. This is a beautiful moment with the prophet. Mary, for the record, was another polyandrous wife. Her husband, Adam Leitner, was not a Mormon, but was on very good terms with Mormon leaders. And amazingly, this didn't seem to have changed with the plural marriages. Brigham Young, quickly cementing his role as Joseph Smith's Dwight Schrute, where polygamy was concerned, performed this marriage also. And it seems that Joseph Smith was treading very carefully. Remember, the John C. Bennett fiasco is exploding all around him during this period. So everything we talked about last episode, and if you haven't listened to that, go back and listen to it first. That's all happening as Joseph Smith's trying to figure out who he could trust to be the assistant regional prophet.
Assistant to the regional prophet. And honestly, by this point in the trajectory of Nauvoo polygamy, it feels like Joseph Smith was working on some sort of bizarro polygamy scavenger hunt. He had so far checked off single woman, already married, husband a faithful Mormon, already married, husband not so happy with Mormonism, already married, husband not Mormon, and widowed sister-in-law. What about mother and daughter? Check. He marries Patty Bartlett and her daughter, Sylvia Sessions. And like most of the marriages during this early period, they were both currently married. Patty to David Sessions and Sylvia to Windsor Lyon. Patty, for her part, is a significant story in my neck of the woods because she is my kid's ancestor and she's buried within running distance from my house. In fact, we visited her just last week again. Now with Sylvia, there's a little bit of a hiccup because we don't quite know when she was married to Joseph Smith. If you remember when we talked about the Joseph S. Smith affidavits, well, there's actually duplicates of almost all of them. In one of them, Sylvia said she was married in February 1842. In the other, it's February 1843. And historian Brian Hales has taken more time than anyone on this matter. He points out that neither of these affidavits are signed, and at the end, it's really just tough to figure out which is right. When Patty, her mother, writes about her March 1842 marriage, she says that Sylvia was present. Now, Patty's account is written 25 years later, but if she's remembering the date right and Sylvia is there, that's actually a good indicator she was probably already married to Joseph Smith, which would make that 1842 date the correct one.
Okay, I'm sorry that Brian had to put on his nerd brain and bore the hell out of all of you, because I get to talk about something way more metal. Deathbed confessions! This is one of the wildest stories in the polygamy canon. It is so fascinating, and it causes a lot of problems for people years later. In 1915, Sylvia's daughter, Josephine, yep, her name is Joseph, Fiend, super sly, is visited by assistant church historian Andrew Jensen. And remember, this is in 1915. So she writes out a statement that she signs, and Josephine basically describes at how in 1882, just a few years before, as Sylvia is about to die, as Josephine's mother is on her deathbed, she calls Josephine, who is then 38 years old, so it's not like she's having a childhood memory or something, to her bedside and, quote, told me that I was the daughter of the prophet Joseph Smith. Well, 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 that was quite the secret. However, before you get too post-happy on Reddit, two things. First, DNA testing has been done, and Josephine is most definitely not Joseph Smith's biological daughter. Can we say most definitely not?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. They've like, because when I was reading Persistence of Polygamy, it was, they still hadn't tested one allele.
I was pretty sure that after that, Ugo had, there was like some new technology had been, and so they had flat, because she was all along was thought to be the main candidate, and as I recall, Ugo flat out rules her out.
Yeah, so we're going to say most definitely not Joseph Smith's biological daughter, although in pictures, she always seemed to look like him too. Okay. Also, Josephine's sister, Phoebe, was apparently also there at the bedside and was told the same thing. And Phoebe later wrote about being born under the covenant of that ceiling. Phoebe, born in 1852, with all thanks to DNA researcher Ugar Perego and his test tubes, we can safely rule out Joseph Smith for Phoebe. Actually, looking at the statement in Josephine Fisher's affidavit in context, you can argue that it doesn't have to mean she was the biological offspring of Joseph Smith anyway. Well, boo, that's much less fun. But I will say that to me, it suggests a sexual relationship.
Yeah, that's such an interesting thing, because Sylvia knew who the father was, I would think. The way that the relationship between her and Windsor and then her and Joseph, it seems like, you know, she would have been clear. Maybe not. I mean, that would be even more fun and interesting, but...
Let me say something to outsiders really quick who have non-Mormons listening to this. The reason why we're even entertaining did Joseph Smith have sex with his wives is you have to understand that in the Mormon community, that is seen as very scandalous. Like, for whatever reason, modern-day polygamists are supposed to be with their plural wives, but for some reason in Nauvoo, we argue that it was just like, I don't know, Puritan union of souls.
And it's so funny because the Book of Mormon justification for it, which is like this backhanded justification from Jacob, right, is that if polygamy is not usually the deal, but if it is, God will command it so that he can raise up seed to him.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the purpose is to have righteous children. So it's so weird that we're constantly being like, no, zero sex.
But that's DNA. Well, and I'll get us off on too many tangents, but non-Mormon listeners, the DNA thing and Joseph's descendants is a big thing, because not only that, but like her descendants, Sylvia Sessions' descendants, believe that they were related to Joseph Smith. It's part of their faith story for like generations.
And then the LDS Church tries to whitewash polygamy out of its history. It's a very odd, and depending on what decade you're in, it's the relationship to it changes. So relatively speaking, Sylvia's mother, Patty, was older. At 47, not like old, but comparatively a little bit older. It seems like she, like the next woman we're going to discuss, played a little bit different role in this polygamy society. The quote-unquote older women often played the role of troubleshooter. So they speak with these younger prospective wives, and they give them the talk. And what did it entail? Great question. Sadly, we don't get any real good stories about, you know, one of the wives saying, I was there, and then Mother Sessions came and talked to me, and we talked about this.
And I hate to keep talking about this because I sound like I sound very ex-Mormon saying this, but I've been watching The Vow about the new Nexium cult with Keith Raniere, and they have this sorority. It's a modern self-help group. It's The Vow on HBO. You can watch it. You should watch it. But they're talking about how the women recruit other women into this secret sex sorority with the leader. And it's hard to not see parallels now, and I wish I didn't, but to me, it seems very similar. Get the women to get you on your downline, your spiritual downline.
It's funny. There's some archaeologists at BYU, and they've actually unearthed some sashes in Nauvoo homes with stripes on them. So
you are full of it. Don't listen to Brian. You really like those sashes.
Oh, it's all sashy. So, you know, we need Anita Stansfield to come along and write us a good polygamy era novel of you know, what this society was like. So, all right. So the next woman we're going to talk about, Sarah Kingsley, like Patty, also a little bit older. She was born in 1788. And like Mary Rollins, her second husband, consecutive, not a plural husband, smart guy, was also this friendly non-Mormon named John Cleveland. Despite that, Emma Smith, good friends with her, chooses Sarah as her counselor when the Relief Society was organized in March 1842. Well, Sarah was very popular in the Smith house because Joseph also chose her as a plural wife. And the weird thing is it's right around the same time as Emma is pulling her into Relief Society leadership. So, different kinds of relationships with Sarah going on in the Smith house. And Sarah's marriage to Joseph Smith is another one of these that's very tough to date. So, she was apparently a witness when Eliza Snow marries Joseph Smith in the summer of 1842. So, that again may indicate that she had already been married and may have even kind of shepherded Eliza through this process. Maybe not. It's not definite. And if there's ever a situation where Sarah, Eliza, and Emma are together, I'm guessing they probably didn't ever play the raise your hand if you're married to Joseph Smith game. There would have been some very surprised faces.
In this time frame, most likely, Joseph married Elizabeth Davis, who was about the same age as Patty Sessions and Sarah Cleveland. And Elizabeth even had Sarah beat, since she was at this point married to her third husband, Jabez Durfee. Did I say that right?
There's all these old weird names that they're awesome.
Bring it back. That should be a Utah Mormon thing, Jabez.
Name your kid Jabez.
Jabez.
Put some extra Z's in there or something to Utah.
You could fit it with no. If you're in Utah, you don't use vowels. So we have perhaps some of our clearest evidence with Elizabeth of the role as go-between. Emily Partridge later wrote about having Elizabeth approach her and set up a meeting with Joseph Smith. Emily was married that night. They move fast. Why does Joseph switch from Brigham and Heber to Patty, Sarah, and Elizabeth to approach prospective wives? I think you can probably answer the question just off the top of your head. Knowing what you know about the Smash Brothers, seriously, could Joseph have picked two dudes who were less suave with the ladies? It's a pretty safe bet that these well-known women in the community would be a lot more effective in successfully introducing other women into the principal. Brigham had no game. I think I've said that a million times. Make me a t-shirt. Brigham had no game. Guess what? Elizabeth was also a mover and shaker in the Relief Society. You might be familiar with a painting where Joseph Smith is like speaking to the whole Relief Society and they're all looking at him with goo-goo eyes and wearing beautiful dresses that the FLDS would later try to emulate. Either the artist had In Sacred Loneliness on their shelf and was just screwing with people, or this was in the most unintentionally hilarious piece of art ever. It's very, like, you expect them to blink and it says, I love you on their eyelids, you know? Emma certainly was hearing the rumors and had to have picked up the vibes with her colleagues in the society. Poor Emma. She literally couldn't escape polygamy anywhere. Nauvoo was all around her, all of her friends.
And as polyandry goes, it's time to kick it up a notch here. Orson Hyde, one of the original 12 apostles, had been on this legendary mission to dedicate Palestine for a couple of years. His wife, Marinda Nancy Johnson, back in Nauvoo, has three children. Then she's commanded by Revelation to go live with the Ebenezer Robinson family. So this is the Sidney Rigdon extended family. And, you know, take that, Jeff Goldblum, in your apartments.com. You know how you really know where to move? Pure revelation. That's how you do it. So a few sentences into the revelation, we get this curious section, quote, "Let my handmaid Nancy Marinda Hyde hearken to the counsel of my servant Joseph in all things whatsoever he shall teach unto her, and it shall be a blessing upon her and upon her children after her." Okay, let's consult our euphemism dictionary, because this whole thing smells very strongly like polygamy. Be that as it may, maybe it wasn't talking about polygamy, she definitely would soon marry Joseph Smith. Or maybe soon-ish, because we just can't have nice things in Nauvoo polygamy land. We, of course, have two options for the win question. And there's a big difference between the two in this case. The first option comes from a list that's written randomly in the back of Joseph Smith's journal, and it's in the handwriting of Thomas Bullock. He wasn't keeping the journal at this time, so because of that, it's a good chance that this list may have been added later. At any rate, his list indicates that Marinda marries Joseph Smith in April 1842. For those keeping score, that is decidedly before Orson Hyde returns from the old mission field. That could have been the king of all Dear John letters, by the way, if Marinda had penned one to old Orson there. Now, a later account from the one, the only wife number 19, Ann Eliza Webb, describes Orson as being, quote, furious when he found out. Seems fair. Okay, option two for the win comes from Marinda's affidavit. So in this, she indicates that it took place in May 1843. So if this is the case, that's both after Orson gets back from his mission and also after he had married a plural wife. This is a tough one. Super sleuth researcher Todd Compton had to wave the white flag and just categorize her experience as, quote, surprisingly underdocumented.
Boy, I'll say. In the interest of continuity, let's talk about another woman who was married to an apostle. Well, sort of. Missed it by that much. Delcina? This is another name. I've never, you know, I wonder what I said in the podcast. Delcina? Delcina Johnson, actually no relation to Marinda, even though they had the same surname, had first married Lyman Sherman. He died in the craziness between Missouri and Nauvoo, and he had been called as an apostle, but was dead before he was actually ordained. So like so many of his women, Delcina had been involved with Mormonism almost since the beginning. Her brother, Benjamin F., later provided some details that are interesting. And according to his account, Joseph Smith has approached their mother, Julia, and explained polygamy to her. Then, just to tie a nice bow on the discussion, asked if he could marry some of her daughters. Notice that was daughters, plural, with an S. Hold on to that. Way to win mom's heart, by the way, Joseph. Benjamin also shares a very small window into the lived reality. Delsina apparently lived with Louisa Beeman, looking for all the world like two single women sharing a house to uninitiated observers. Benjamin indicated that Joseph Smith provided for their comfort, whatever that entailed. These women, of course, were rare non-polyandrous cases where they didn't continue to live with their previous husbands.
Now, most of these women we've talked about so far are likely unfamiliar. If you know anything about Mormon women, however, you will definitely recognize the next name, Eliza Roxy Snow. And she's not just the subject of the shirt I'm currently wearing, though she definitely is that. She is one of
He just literally unzipped like he was Superman in the phone booth. Polygamy
man.
Don't say it like that.
The crappiest superhero ever. Here to give you all the nerdy details you've been waiting for. So yes, she is the subject of my shirt, but she's also one of the most famous Mormons of all time. Men, women, everyone knows Eliza R. Snow's name. And Sister Eliza usually used her pen in writing poetry, some of which becomes hymn texts. However, on June 29th, 1842, she starts keeping a journal. First up, she tried her hand at vintage vague booking. Her first sentence, quote, "This is a day of much interest to my feelings." Yeah, I'd say days on which you marry the prophet as a plural wife tend to be interesting days. We can all agree on that. If you're thinking that Mormonism's most literate woman would not write anything less than an eloquent description of her feelings at the time, you are correct, sir. Later, during the Utah period, she looked back on this tumultuous time. In Nauvoo, I first understood that the practice of plurality of wives was to be introduced into the church. The subject was very repugnant to my feelings. So directly was it in opposition to my educated prepossessions that it seemed as though all the prejudices of my ancestors for generations past congregated around me. But when I reflected that I was living in the dispensation of the fullness of times, embracing all other dispensations, surely plural marriage must necessarily be included, and I consoled myself with the idea that it was far in the distance and beyond the period of my mortal existence. It was not long, however, after I received the first intimation, before the commandment reached me, that the set time had come, that God had commanded his servants to establish the order by taking additional wives. I knew that God was speaking. As I increased in knowledge concerning the principle and design of plural marriage, I grew in love with it. All right, for you then, Eliza.
Emma was about to get punched in the face yet again. Eliza, both her good friend and colleague in the Relief Society, had married her husband without Emma's knowledge. I mean, sisters, think about this in Relief Society. Your best friend in your ward is secretly married to your husband. It's gotta hurt. 2 months after the marriage, Eliza moved into the Smith house and cue one of the most infamous stories of Nauvoo. How infamous? Well, it's Brian's wearing the story. That's how infamous it is. In an account that would make the game of telephone jealous, Eliza is on the stairs. I'm going to give you some iteration. We're going to tell you what we know. Eliza's on the stairs, hugging, maybe perhaps smooching Joseph, maybe even full of a baby. Who knows? When Emma sees them and she's like pissed halfway into next week, Emma chucks Eliza down the stairs. Maybe drags her down the stairs, maybe trips her down the stairs. There's stairs involved and someone's down them. And in some versions, Eliza was pregnant and the injuries both caused a miscarriage and prevented Eliza from ever having children again. Yeah, sorry, Brian Chirp, but the whole stairs thing is probably crappy Harlequin level fiction. We know something happened at the house because basically Eliza is thrown out and she writes about it, but we now think that the miscarriage story might really be related to a gang rape incident in Missouri from the mob. And Andrea Radke Moss came up with this theory, and you can read more about her research. It's pretty interesting. But the Emma Eliza throwdown wasn't over. And by the way, I'm team Emma on this. Eliza and I used to love Eliza, but she's kind of rubbed me the wrong way over the years reading her history. But the throwdown wasn't over. The next year, Emma finds letters in Joseph's jacket from Eliza. And, you know, I'm sure those love letters by Eliza or Snow were not small things. Emma was already having a rough time because, like Brother Presley taught us, we can't go on together with suspicious minds and these letters. The obvious conclusion is that they were some flavor of love letters, obviously, and they really set her off. I mean, you got to think that whatever she saw and then to keep seeing that, that's got to be really hard for her. Joseph also gave Eliza a gold watch, and Emma didn't discover that one, but she did find that Joseph gave it to another wife of his, Flora Woodworth. Remember, this isn't him two-timing the watch recipient since he was technically 37 timing everyone. That's a good joke. Brian wrote that. And I'm glad he wrote this script because my mind would not have let it be this short. Oh, it's not short, you say? Well, we're not done yet. One fun last thing about Eliza, when Joseph Smith's wives are unceremoniously divvied up to church leaders after his death, Eliza marries Brigham, who had performed her marriage to Joseph Smith. And there was no, quote, choice of my heart stuff this time. There's no romance. There's no indication that either have managed to do anything more than tolerate the other part. Maybe some grudging respect on a really, really good day. But Brigham died in 1877, and then Emma followed. Do you think that's true? You don't think Emma and Eliza and Brigham liked each other? Not romantically.
I think they may have respected the other's talents, but there's really no indication that there was.
But they knew how to run a kingdom together. That's what I see them doing.
There's no personal relationship, but then Brigham didn't have personal relationships.
They're more a house of cards scenario in my mind.
Yeah.
So Brigham died in 1877, and then Emma followed 2 years later. And incidentally, Eliza pushed Emma's argument that Joseph was never a polygamist down the metaphorical stairs on numerous occasions. Another solid joke there, Brian. The following year, Eliza began writing her name Eliza R. Snow Smith. That's a dainty lace-covered Victorian middle finger to both the line of the Lord and the elect lady. Oh, snap, Eliza.
If you'll humor me, we got to venture into some very murky territory to talk about the next woman. I know, get it, we've already wandered around in the weeds enough tonight. Tough cookies. Sarah Poulterer is particularly difficult to talk about with any certainty. Here we go. It seems that her maiden name was Rapson, R-A-P-S-O-N. When John C. Bennett publishes his book, he made the guy setting the type use more asterisks than he had in his entire career up to that point. So the thing was, is he wouldn't name Joseph Smith's wives. He would do the first initial of the last name and then asterisks for each letter. So Miss B, asterisk, 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 in Bennett's book, later morphs into Babson, B-A-P-S-O-N, apparently thinking of Rapson, confusing it. So when she dies, her obituary said that she was, quote, intimately acquainted with the prophet Joseph. There's Victorian euphemisms there for you. Lorenzo Snow felt like covering his eternal bases, and he has a sealing performed in the temple, as he did in every case where he felt like it was iffy. So Sarah gets sealed to Joseph one way or the other. Who was Sarah? What was her deal? Sorry, ladies and dudes, we have basically nothing for you. But buck up, though. The next chapter has got some doozies. In the Make Emma's Life Difficult quilt, make sure you notice that square in the middle with Joseph marries her friend's daughters, which is, of course, stitched in super cute cursive. It's really a nice square.
So it's basically like the Pinterest vinyl version now. Yeah.
Like, you know, if you go into the DOP museum and catch them unaware, they'll show you the quilt in the back. It's pretty awesome. So when Sarah Ann Whitney marries Joseph Smith in July 1842, that was something. So Emma had known her and her mother, Elizabeth Ann, since the Kirtland days. She'd actually lived with them for a time. So if you step back a second, you remember the other side of the coin is that Joseph then knew his prospective wife since she was 6. I mean, she was only the ripe old age of 17 when they got married, but if that part sounds a little bit too much like the SNL game show hosted by Tina Fey called Meet Your Second Wife, you're right, and gross.
In this case, both parents were apparently 100% on board. Again, the whole angels and flaming swords plus threats of damnation equals consent, right? Equation? No. Wrong. Anywho, her father, Bishop Newell Whitney, performed the ceremony while her mother watched. how, you ask, did they get to the point of supporting this? I'm just going to share Elizabeth's own words because it's nice to have her own words. And honestly, it sounds like they could be ripped out of the Ensign, which is the church's newspaper or magazine, or used to be anyway. Sorry, the Liahona. You know what? That's what we're calling it now. It was the Liahona for outside countries. Then it's the Ensign for Americans. Now it's just the Liahona. Awesome. Just so you know, this is not about polygamy. My husband revealed these things to me. We had always been united and had the utmost faith and confidence in each other. We pondered upon the matter continually, and our prayers were unceasing that the Lord would grant us some special manifestation concerning this new and strange doctrine. The Lord was very merciful to us. He revealed unto us his power and glory. We were seemingly wrapped in heavenly vision, a halo of light encircled us, and we were convinced in our own bosoms that God heard and approved our prayers and intercedings before him. Our hearts were comforted and our faith made so perfect that we were willing to give our eldest daughter, then 17 years of age, to Joseph in the order of plural marriage.
Thanks, Mom.
I mentioned her father performed the marriage, but I didn't mention that the words for the ceremony were given in a revelation, did I? Now, the original hasn't survived. We only have copies. This was a very popular squirt gun in the arsenal of polygamy deniers when it appeared in a recent Joseph Smith Papers volume. In fact, Denver Snuffer consigned Joseph Smith Papers editors to hell over it. Really. Since you may not be familiar, in this worldview, any document dealing with Joseph Smith and polygamy not dating from 1841 to 1844 is automatically made up. That's the story. Psst, anything from that time period is still made up too. This line of reasoning would be a whole lot more effective if there weren't two other documents, contemporary documents that are 100% in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And I just want to say something else about this. Again, I've been watching all these shows, but I, working with many polygamists and seeing people that have given their daughters to someone like, you know, Warren Jeffs or something, young daughters. The reasoning I don't think was the same as this. I mean, I think it's rooted in under certain things, but what it reminded me of is when I watched that movie on, what's the one in Waco?
50 Shades of Grey?
No, the one in Waco.
About David Koresh?
Yeah, there's a scene where a man gives his wife over and they give their little sister. And you think about, how do you convince someone to do this? It's so hard for me. But yeah, if you're a polygamy denier, you have to contend with the fact that there are not just extant things and later reminiscences. There are contemporary reports too.
So the first of these two documents is a letter written to brother and sister Whitney and et cetera. And one shroot buck to you if you can figure out who et cetera is. Yeah, it's Sarah. And this letter is... of all the documents we have regarding polygamy, I think this is the most fascinating. And in this letter, Joseph about hyperventilates in ink. He writes that, quote, "My feelings are so strong for you since what has passed lately between us." He exhorts them, quote, "Burn this letter as soon as you read it. Keep all locked up into your breasts. My life depends on it. One thing I want to see for you is to get the fullness of my blessing sealed upon our heads." Very interesting pronoun there. Really glad they didn't burn the letter. Oh, and one other thing. He tells them, quote, "Find out when Emma comes, then you cannot be safe. But when she is not here, there is the most perfect safety." Okay. And at this point, he's hiding it so Missouri can't yoink him out of Illinois. Remember, this is the whole charge of trying to murder Boo, Hiss, villain, Lilburn Boggs. Now, this marriage just happens to take place when Emma is out of Nauvoo. And get your stiff beverage handy because it gets worse. Emma is headed to Springfield. Yeah, Joseph Smith takes advantage of Emma being gone in an effort to save his can so that he can marry a plural wife. The optics of this one are not good. Not good at all. So, and he's not going to all this trouble so he can just have a nice friendly discussion with the 17-year-old. Then, the next year, there's a blessing for Sarah Ann. And again, it's in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And this may not be setting off flashing lights and bells, but by this point in the 1840s, Joseph Smith rarely writes anything himself. He's got scribes. If he's in hiding, he brings a scribe with him. So when he writes something himself, it's always something that has particular intimate interest to him personally. So this blessing text beseeches God to, quote, crown her with a diadem of glory in the eternal worlds, if she remain in the everlasting covenant to the end, close quote. And then, for good measure, later there's talk of her being, quote, crowned with all the fullness of glory of the everlasting gospel. And here, Joseph Smith is playing $100,000 pyramid. He's screaming everything he can without saying the specific word polygamy. So if you want to deny Joseph Smith was a polygamist, Sarah Ann Whitney is someone you definitely want to pretend doesn't exist. Is it possible there's another wonky twist to her story? Oh, see, friend, of course.
In 1973, a very curious oversized pamphlet was published by Gerald and Sandra Tanner. Written by Mike Marquardt, the title was The Strange Marriages of Sarah Ann Whitney to Joseph Smith the Mormon Prophet, Joseph C. Kingsbury, and Heber C. Kimball. We've talked about Joseph. Forget Heber for the moment. What about this Kingsbury guy? A month after her blessing was recorded, Sarah Ann married Joseph C. Kingsbury in a civil ceremony. And this was essentially a sham marriage. For all curious observers, they would look and see Sarah happily married to Kingsbury. However, if you're thinking of how noble a move this was by Joseph Kingsbury, rest assured that he definitely submitted a bill to the church after his death. A bill for $8,000 for taking care of her. More than $200,000 in current value. Pretty sure that one got ignored. Yeah, so something was definitely up with that marriage, and apparently plural wives are expensive to take care of.
A strange marriage. What do you want?
Well, after that whole tale, it's time to say goodnight for part one. Come back next time to see Joseph Smith get shut down, but then respond nicely by marrying about a million other women. Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I've sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, brother Young. That only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young. The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.